After COVID-19 cut short the 2020 legislative session, lawmakers are juggling more bills than ever to make up for lost time. Center for Arizona Policy is supporting at least 17 pro-life, pro-family, and pro-religious freedom bills. Now is a good time to learn about what bills could end up on Governor Ducey's desk. CAP's president, Kathy Arid, talks about how CAP goes about its legislative agenda and where this session might lead. Here now is Cindy Dahlgren.
All right, welcome to Engage Arizona. I'm Cindy Dahlgren, here with CAP President Kathy Arid. We wanted to do a podcast about key legislation at the state capitol this session, and it made no sense to go elsewhere when we have someone right here who knows all the ins and outs of the key bills and what's going on behind the background and the strategic dynamic involved. So we chose to talk to Kathy. Kathy has been working with Arizona legislators on special issue legislation over 20 years now. 20, 25?
Probably over 30.
Oh, 30.
Or close to 30.
She has built relationships with many policymakers and other decision makers. She has been involved in hundreds of bills over the years, either working to stop them or working to get them passed. She boasts, 174 CAP laws?
Something like that.
Yeah. Over the years. So, Kathy, first tell us, how does CAP go about putting together a legislative agenda?
Well, thanks for that question, Cindy. It's a combination of things. One is, are the votes there? So in this current legislative session, we have basically, you have to have 31 votes in the House to pass a bill, 16 in the Senate to pass a bill, and of course a governor that will sign the bill. So you're always looking to see, is this issue going to get 31, 16, and 1? So that's one of the concerns. And then, but the key is, what problems would the legislation solve? So that's just the familiar refrain at the Capitol, is this bill going to solve a problem? So we do look for what problems, could legislation solve problems, and what's going on around the country. So we'll look at court cases, at other states, at problems in our state to be solved, and just kind of do some fairly extensive research before we start to put together our agenda that we'd be advocating.
And so this year, CAP has 17 bills this session that it's directly involved in. And that is a lot. But let's talk about the pro-life laws first, because that's close to your heart. Let's talk about Senate Bill 1457.
Well, Senate Bill 1457, that is one that we looked at. What's the latest on court cases? What are ways that we can, protect preborn babies and their mothers? That's our first priority, is how can we save the lives of preborn babies and also take care of the needs of their mothers to make sure that their mothers have, if you want to use the other side's terminology, true choice, informed choice, that they know what their options are. Because we know that when many women are presented with their options and a support system or how they could proceed to have childbirth, then they're going to choose life over having an abortion. So 1457 does a number of things. Key is that it sets forth a pro-life policy in this state, and it would prohibit abortions because of genetic abnormalities. Now, genetic abnormalities is not my favorite term, but that is a legal term that's been advised by the lawyers that are dealing with these cases in court. And it basically goes, the best example, of course, is the child with Down syndrome. And that we know that in our country, about 67% of the children diagnosed in utero with Down syndrome are being aborted. In other countries, it's like down to none or very few. And so these children are precious, certainly in God's sights, but also in the families that are raising them. So we want to encourage, those lives should not be aborted. And so that would be a huge step forward in our state. The bill also does a number of other things. One of our big concerns, we know that with what the abortion industry, we know that their goal is selling as many abortions as they can. And they want to be able to send the abortion pills for chemical abortions, medication abortions, by the mail. And we're like, no, not in our state.
Without a doctor's visit.
Right, exactly.
And so some of the complications with that, I mean, what we heard from Mackenzie during the testimony there, some of the complications with that is if you don't have a doctor's visit, then there's no way of telling the true gestational age of the unborn baby and a number of other things.
Yeah, and my biggest concern there is I'm sure many of us, if not all of us, know of someone who had an ectopic pregnancy. And an undiagnosed ectopic pregnancy can cause the woman to die. So if you are sending abortion pills that are supposed to be taken through the first 10 months, if you send abortion pills to a woman and she's supposed to take it through the first 10 weeks of pregnancy, is she really 10 weeks along in her pregnancy? We hear stories of women taking it at much later dates. and if she has an ectopic pregnancy, there she is at home taking these pills, or even if an infection sets in. And that, of course, was part of, I think, Mackenzie's story. But we know that this can be very harmful to women, and we certainly don't support abortion, but we want to look out for women's health and safety at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So there's another bill. Talk a little bit about 1251 and 2404, the same identical bills, but this is a third attempt at this.
Right, and yeah, we it's an interesting fight on this bill. It's called the Family Health Pilot Program, and the intent is to have state dollars available for a program, a nonprofit program, that would identify women that are seeking to have an abortion. That's very important. They're seeking to have an abortion. It would be a statewide network that these women would be, there'd be an outreach to these women, and then they would be provided services that would take them all the way through, if they chose to avail themselves of these services, all the way through pregnancy, and then even beyond through the first 2 years of the child's life. So this is, you know, people say, oh, the woman knows what she wants to do before she goes to have an abortion. Well, it's just not true. And of course, we heard testimony from a young woman named Tina. If Tina had had these resources 12 years ago, she likely would not have had an abortion and gone through a really tough struggle for 12 years now because of the emotional and physical impact of having had an abortion.
And a lot of people will say, well, there are a lot of resources already available, and some of them publicly funded, right? And then there are the pregnancy resource centers. But this is a little different, and it's not that easy to find. I mean, if you want an abortion, you know exactly where to go. But if you don't, or you don't know what your options are, you're in a state of crisis. It's not that simple.
The pro-abortion industry likes to come in on these bills, and it's hard to just not scream, you know, even with, if we're doing online Zoom or whatever, to just say, no, wait a minute, these, you know, they try to say all these programs that they have that are available, well, they're all taxpayer funded, but they're all very much with a one-sided view that is not really promoting adoption. It's not really promoting childbirth. It's more, if adoption and childbirth are mentioned, it's not the highest priority. It's more, here are your birth control pills, here are your abortifacients, here's how to get an abortion. And so so what? What is wrong with having a program at really a fairly small level of funding that would intentionally reach women who are actively seeking to have an abortion? And, you know, I'm often reminded of when some would say, well, let's make abortion safe, legal, and rare. And the abortion industry has certainly proven through the years they're not interested in making abortion rare.
No, not at all.
Or not even safe.
Well, many states are pushing heartbeat bills and very aggressive, basically almost nearly bans on abortions altogether. And some people are asking why we're not doing the same. It's a legitimate question, but it's just not that simple. There's so many more things to take into consideration. Talk a little bit about why.
Great question, and one of the more challenging questions and decisions that I have to face at Center for Arizona Policy. If I could today snap my fingers and abortion would be illegal and we would be taking care of mothers and children, I certainly would do it. The problem is that none of the heartbeat bills in any court in the country has upheld them as valid. They've all been overturned, and that's the case with some of these laws. So a big part of when we're analyzing what do we want to advocate on the life side? It's what is likely to be upheld as constitutional, what might set up the right type of legal challenge in the courts, and what's going to save babies quickest. And you know, you've got two sides. You've got, you know, we have long favored the incremental approach. We have seen the incremental approach work. The other thing that I need to point out is that right now, pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, is a law from Mississippi that would ban abortions after 15 weeks. They haven't decided whether they're going to take the case or not. Yes, we have new justices that we hope will be pro-life, but we don't know that. And so part of it is a legal strategy to try to set up the best case. And I don't want to get in the weeds too much here, but what's the best case to set up and to play into the national legal strategy to try to overturn Roe versus Wade and have abortion no longer available or legal in our country? And right now, heartbeat's really not part of that overall legal strategy. But a ban on abortions because of genetic abnormality, that is part of the strategy. And so that's what we're pursuing. That's a strategic decision that we have made. Would I love to see a heartbeat bill pass and be upheld all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court? Of course. The other factor to know in Arizona, though, is that we still have a law in the books from before 1973, when Roe versus Wade was overturned, made abortion legal in our country. Our pre-Roe law says that abortion is illegal in our state. So when Roe is overturned, we believe that our pre-Roe law could spring back into effect, and that would be before the heartbeat. And so to pass heartbeat now wouldn't be really the strongest law that we could have on the books. The pre-Roe law is the strongest law that we could have on the books.
And while we watch these go through the courts, in the meantime, some of these incremental approaches can be saving babies along the way and serving the women.
That's right. And we have the statistics to show that in Arizona, because our abortion rate has gone down, our abortion ratio has gone down, and even with our population growth, and the abortion numbers are still much higher than we think they should be, but even with our significant population growth over the last 10 years, we have not seen the abortion numbers increase. And so that is a positive that these laws are working.
So I mentioned that the life issue is close to your heart. That's why we started with that. So talk a little bit about that. Open up a little bit. Tell us why.
Well, because, you know, I have seen too many friends, close acquaintances, even a loved one. I've seen what abortion does to women. We know that abortion takes, you know, I've often said abortion stops a beating heart. We know that abortion takes the life of an unborn child. But in my view, abortion also breaks a woman's heart, that abortion hurts women, whether it's infertility issues, whether it's other physical complications, or the emotional trauma of having had an abortion. And so to me, why I get up every day and do this work, obviously because I believe God's called me to it, but also because there are women out there that are having abortions, and that feeling just such an obligation and calling to try to help those women and reach those women to choose life and not abortion. And that's, you know, in many ways has become my life's work. And I think that we know that God's the creator of life, and there's no more important mission in our country and in our culture and our churches today than standing for those unborn children and their mothers.
What have you learned over the years about the fight for life and what has changed?
A great question. I would say the key thing that I've learned is maybe for the first part of the pro-life movement, there wasn't as much concern about the mother, about the woman having an abortion, and there was more of a complete focus on the baby. And I've often said that if we're not as concerned about the woman walking into an abortion clinic as we are about her unborn child, we might as well pack it up and go home. That I do see two victims, and I do see a woman in need. We know that most women have an abortion because they don't have a support system, that they don't, either the male is not there, the family support is not there. And so the incredible work of pregnancy resource centers to reach women certainly has been a huge role. I think also that we've seen, you know, when you see a lot of different political movements or movements for something like making, you know, overturning legalized abortion, the pro-life movement today is stronger. It just goes stronger every year. And when we see a group like Students for Life of America that says we are the pro-life generation, and we see evidence of that. And so we are turning the tide on the life issue. And that's just something that I think that, you know, there are two ways to look at it. Yes, we want abortion to not be legal, but we also want abortion to be unthinkable. And so that anyone who's considering an abortion knows that they have a better option. And, you know, I applaud the women who have been bold and courageous enough to come forward and say, I had an abortion and I regret my abortion and here's why. And there's nothing more sad or, you know, like to give you goosebumps, to put it that way, than to hear from a woman who had an abortion and how she suffered from it. And so that has done more for people, I think, to understand. You know, two things I would say too. I could talk about this forever, of course. Ultrasound technology, that there's no question that when people see the ultrasound image of a baby as early as, what, 8, 9, or 10 weeks, you cannot deny that that is a human life, and that all from the moment of conception, all that it takes is that baby continues to develop and grow until they have a live birth. So I think the combination of ultrasound technology and women who have been harmed by abortion speaking out, that has done as much as, along with these laws, to inform women that abortion is not the best option.
And you mentioned making sure that they know that they have options. And one of the CAP-supported bills this session is on an adoption bill. Talk briefly about that.
Well, this bill, Senate Bill 1254, would set up a website, basically Adoption AZ, that adoption is a loving option. Our Department of Health Services has some things on their website about adoption, but they're buried. You really can't find them very easily.
I tried to look.
Yeah, I've tried several times, and then I finally find it. So this would just be on the homepage and just make it prominent that, you know, the woman who is doing a Google search is looking for information on adoption, that Department of Health Services would have information prominently on their website, and a task force would be developed to help them develop that information.
Okay, so we'll move on to some other things. We're not shy. CAP takes on some pretty controversial bills this session as well. There's sex education, there's the prohibition on counseling bans, and then a few educational freedom bills. Let's first talk about the sex education bill. Arizona's pretty strong on parental rights, even including education choices. So why do we need this?
We need Senate Bill 1456 to ensure that parents have access to all the instructional materials that are used on sex education in the public school classroom. Part of the bill would simply not allow sex education in grades kindergarten through fourth grade on the theory that the young children do not need sex education. But then starting in fifth grade, the bill includes things like a 60-day, basically no, 60-day period for parents to be able to access any school sex education curriculum that's being considered by the school board, have an opportunity to weigh in on it, really to empower parents at the local level to be able to have their voices heard in a very compelling manner on sex education curriculum. And also to clarify, you know, when we talk about sex education, was that just sex education, or is it also things on sexual orientation, gender identity, HIV, AIDS education? So to clarify that parents have to opt their children into those classes. You know, I got asked recently, well, why opt in versus opt out? And, you know, just picture little Johnny with his backpack and there's the permission slip, or, you know, to opt him out. You know, there's the former mom or dad can opt out Johnny from being in sex ed. Do you think that ever makes it to the parent, or how often does it make it to the parent? So opt in just ensures that the parent knows that they have to give written permission for their child to be in a sex education class in their district and charter schools. And this is empowering parents, protecting the family unit, and that those families who have views about sex education and want to keep that within the home and be the ones to teach their children, that they continue to maintain that ability and that parental right to do so.
Now, the opposition will say, you know, not every parent is paying attention in there, and kids will learn off the internet or something if they're not taught some of these basic things in the schools. What's your answer to that?
Well, let's hope that parents, when they have to opt in and they're asked to opt in, and depending on when the school district provides it, that this is a way to engage parents and to bring parents. And, you know, parents have responsibilities and rights in how they oversee the education of their children, and this is part of their responsibility and their rights.
So let's talk a little bit. The Human Rights Campaign recently admitted that sex education is really about getting their LGBTQ agenda out there. The quote was this: sex ed is a logical venue to help all youth learn about and encourage acceptance for LGBTQ people and families. Now, certainly, you know, all people are equal and acceptable. That's not what we're talking about here. But what are they talking about, acceptance?
Well, the Human Rights Campaign is making this a political issue. It's part of their political agenda to not only have toleration of different types of sexuality, but also acceptance, to force acceptance and to normalize sexual behavior, regardless of a family's personal beliefs, moral beliefs, religious beliefs about human sexuality. And so this, again, is a parental issue, that this is not sex education in schools. If the parent chooses to opt their child in, it should not be part of a political agenda to force one viewpoint. If anything, sex education in the school should be neutral and just present health-related concerns or facts, and that's where parents need to be really aware of it's what's being taught.
Yeah, sex ed is different from when I grew up.
Exactly.
But on that same, you know, on that same level, we have this prohibition on counseling bans. Now, we've seen these so-called conversion therapy bans pop up in different states and different municipalities throughout the country. Tell us a little bit about why this is a preemptive bill.
Right.
So tell us about this and what this would do and why it's necessary.
Well, the way I like to explain it is, you know, mom or dad, imagine that your 14-year-old son comes to you and says that he's been asked out on a date by another boy. And your 14-year-old son says, I don't believe I'm gay, but I'm tempted, I'm kind of interested in going out on a date with this boy. And I know that's not what our family believes, but I need to sort through these feelings. I need to understand you know, am I gay? Am I not? You know, why am I tempted? That type of thing. So as the parent, you want to go get professional counseling for your child to help them deal with these feelings. Well, in Pima County, where Tucson is, the Pima County ordinance says, sorry, mom or dad, you cannot get that type of counseling for your child and pay a fee. If you get a volunteer counselor, fine. But you, and or mom or dad, if you want to, if your child says, hey, I'm gay and I just want to help counseling to help me affirm my sexuality, that's okay. You know, mom or dad, you can go and, you know, pay a fee for that, and that's not against the Pima County ordinance. So what the whole move around the country is to do something called ban conversion therapy. Well, and conversion therapy has gotten a bad name. I won't go into all of that. But really, we're talking about talk therapy. And so what Senate Bill 1482 would do, or similar laws, is it would say that government can basically not say, cannot prevent licensed counselors from treating patients, clients, who are seeking help to overcome unwanted same-sex attraction or gender identity issues. And so it's kind of like, okay, if it's one way, you can get help to affirm it. Why can't you also get help to when you want to know how to overcome it? And we certainly, my guess is most people now know someone who is, I don't know that I like the term ex-gay, but someone who maybe spent some time, but a former homosexual, a former lesbian, a former transgender person who decides that that's not their beliefs, that's not their values, that's not their inclination. And so they've come out of that lifestyle, or however you want to put it. And that's why let's recognize that and not just have it be one point of view. So it does get controversial. There's no question about that. And I've often said, okay, just take it out of the realm of the LGBTQ agenda. This is the government telling a parent what type of help you can or cannot get for your minor child. And if today it's the LGBT issue, what will it be tomorrow that the government says, sorry, mom or dad, we know better than you, and you can't get that help for your child. So this is a really critical parents' rights issue. And the other thing is, in out of Florida, there was a Circuit Court of Appeals decision. It's unconstitutional. You're telling the counselor, you're restricting the counselor's free speech, that you're telling the counselor what they can and cannot say in a counseling session, and that violates the First Amendment.
And doesn't it do the same for the client?
Yes, exactly. Right.
Yeah, because it's content, viewpoint. I might have them all wrong, but something to that effect, right? You can't prohibit one form of speech and not another.
Exactly.
All right, so there are three educational freedom bills that CAP is supporting. One increases the cap in Lexi's Law, which hasn't been increased since the inception in 2009. This is a scholarship account program for students with special needs. There's also a bill to include low-income students in the ESA program. Talk about that one. I know there's a lot of pushback on this, but it's a little different because we're living in a time of COVID now, and it's been a year of many students not having instruction.
Our approach at CAP is that it's up to the parent how they educate their child. We want to support all forms of education, all forms of options. That's what educational freedom is all about. So the Senate bill that would expand the empowerment scholarship accounts, the ESAs, to low-income children and low-income families would enable them in these neighborhoods, especially where they've had the schools closed because of COVID, it would enable them quickly to get basically an ESA to whether they do different types of online learning, whether they go to a private school, whether they go to a charter school that might be open, where the district school is not open. So really this is about helping parents, helping students get the best education they can.
Okay, so and what do you expect will happen with that?
Well, it's gonna be tight. You know, it's been an interesting week when we're recording this. Unfortunately, school choice is a political football. And it has been a political football with the main ESA bill. So we will see what happens. I'm optimistic. We do have a struggle in the Arizona House to get to 31 votes. We have probably 29 votes. So we need to get two more votes confirmed to be able to get the ESA bill. The governor would be supportive, is my understanding. The governor has been a strong school choice proponent. So I think that we all see a need to help these kids. And so we'll see what happens.
And aren't those low-income students the ones that are most at risk during this pandemic? Because if everything moves to online, they don't always have those resources.
Exactly. They may not have a computer at home. They may not have both parents working at home. They may be a single mom or a single dad that are working how many jobs are they trying to work during the COVID pandemic to just put food on the table? So, yes, you can't, these are the children that are probably the most hurt by the pandemic from an educational standpoint and the most in need of alternatives. And these are the parents that want them. These are the parents that want them. I mean, we've had a number of leaders in the African-American community that have come forward saying that this is a civil rights issue and that this should that this is the civil rights issue of our time. To enable children to have the best education.
All right, so let's move on to religious freedom issues. So House Bill 2648, this aims to avoid some of the problems we've seen in other places in the country where they have closed down churches but not other businesses during the pandemic. But we didn't have a problem with that here, but tell us why we still need that law here.
Well, and I need to applaud Governor Ducey for he has very much respected the First Amendment rights of churches, of private religious schools, and has not come close to closing down religious schools or churches. He's certainly been the opposite of a Governor Cuomo or a Governor Newsom, and we're grateful for that. The concern is in future pandemics, who will be governor? Who will be in the state legislature? We don't know that. In 2 years from now, we'll have a new governor. And so this House Bill 2648 will simply say that religion is an essential service and that you cannot treat religion, you cannot discriminate against religion and treat it differently than you do other businesses. Whether it's the casino, whether it's the open mall, whether it's the enclosed mall in other states where we have seen these issues. And so this is just to make sure in Arizona law that we in essence codify what we have seen from Supreme Court decisions about the New York and California restrictions and what we've seen in Governor Ducey's executive orders.
And we saw, at least the last committee that it came out of, some bipartisan support.
Yes, we had one Democrat vote in favor, and I think we'll have another one. We may have had two. So hopeful, I mean, this should be bipartisan because obviously it's not saying only some churches are essential services. You can't discriminate against any religious institution, and you have to treat them as an essential service just like you would Target.
So CAP tracks every bill that's filed at the state legislature, because you never know what's gonna come up. And there are usually a lot of what we like to call bad bills. So tell us some of the bad bills this session and what makes them bad.
Well, we probably have, I don't know, at least 50, if not more of that. And when you talk about the tracking, I need to first say, in addition to all the bills we're supporting, we probably are at least 4 or 5 bills that we have amendments on, if not, and that number seems to be growing daily almost. But on the bad bills, they range from repealing the pro-life laws that we've seen to work to allow basically anyone or a parent has to sign on for a minor's consent to have an abortion or the minor has to get a court order to allow someone who may just be a buddy of the minor to sign on. I mean, it's almost that weak to give parental consent for an abortion. To restrict religious freedom, to say, for example, our law has been very strong that if you're a healthcare professional who will not provide or refer for abortions, one of the bills would say you have to post a notice that says, I don't do abortions before you come in, or, you know, kind of list all the services that you will not provide to a patient. Just kind of ridiculous things, things that would certainly restrict religious freedom, that, you know, in the non-discrimination laws, certainly no one supports discrimination, but the non-discrimination laws that make it a statewide non-discrimination law to add classes of sexual orientation, gender identity to our statewide laws. And we like to say that these non-discrimination laws are supposed to be a shield to protect people from unjust discrimination. What these bills would do is be used as a sword to go after people of faith who are trying to conduct their businesses in accordance with their faith. The things that would, like, for example, a domestic violence shelter, not even take it out of the religious context or your faith-based context, in Anchorage, Alaska, a domestic violence shelter open for women. The ordinance, the law in Alaska meant that men that are identifying as women would have to be admitted into the sleeping quarters where women were that were vulnerable to women who had been abused by men. And so this is where some of these things are just crazy because it's not protecting women, it's not protecting children. So thankfully, we don't see any of those bills making it through yet. But we'll continue to monitor. And sometimes it's as important what doesn't get through as what does pass.
Because these bills come up every year.
Oh, yes.
So it tells me that, this is what we could be seeing if things were a little different in the state legislature.
Well, and thankfully, in November of 2020, Arizona voters elected 31 House members and 16 Senate members who support pro-life, pro-family, pro-freedom issues. And so that's why when we talk about these bad bills, that's why we don't believe we'll be able to, we'll see them get through, because who got elected in the election. So that's why elections matter. You know, sometimes with the slim margins, it's hard to pass some things because everyone has their own opinions. But at least the bad things are not likely to get through because of what the voters did in November.
Well, thank you for your overview.
Thank you.
A lot of people are working, living their life, doing their thing, and they don't really have the time, or they're just not privy to what's going on at the state capitol. So this sort of boils things down, keeps us up to date. We'll have to come back and do this again in May or June and see how the bills did.
Sounds great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Engage Arizona, Public Policy for Daily Life. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe, rate, and give a review on any podcast platform you use. For more information, visit azpolicy.org.